The Bob Murphy Show, episode 316.
There's a tidal wave coming. What you gonna do?
Get ready for another episode of The Bob Murphy Show, the podcast promoting free markets, free minds, and grateful souls. It's your source for commentary and interviews conducted by a Christian and economist. Now here's your host, Bob Murphy.
Hey everybody, welcome back to The Bob Murphy Show. Today I'm speaking with Stephan Kinsella, who is a libertarian writer and attorney in Houston. And specifically, we're going to be talking about his new book, Legal Foundations of a Free Society. But beyond us going through the book per se, we have a freewheeling conversation, talking a lot about our respective origin stories. We learned some things about each other. And what I really like is we got into the weeds of this about the innovations that Murray Rothbard made to libertarian legal theory, but also the drawbacks or chinks in the armor that Stephan thinks that he and others patched up somewhat. I'm probably mixing metaphors there. So in any event, I think it's a real fun but informative episode, and I hope you folks enjoy it. Here's my discussion with Stephan. Stephan, welcome back to the Bob Murphy Show.
Thank you, Bob.
So the reason for your appearance here, besides just that you're a smart guy and an entertaining guest, is you have a relatively new book that's out, The Legal Foundations of a Free Society. So do you want to tell the good folks what that's like? What made you decide to put this collection together?
Well, that's a good question for people who are interested, which I guess is your audience. Over the last, say, 30 years, I have written articles incrementally addressing issues which I thought I could contribute to in libertarian and economic theory. And I put them together in a book, finally, after public acclaim and request. That's a joke. It's a series of articles, but they are assembled in a way like Rothbard wrote his Ethics of Liberty to integrate together. Mm-hmm. So to me, it was like rights theory, property theory, causality, contracts, and various other issues, and they sort of come together. And so I put them together, but it took a long time because if you don't have a publisher behind you or editors or whatever, it's hard to do this, but I figured it out.
Yeah. And I know we kid each other a lot, but it looks very professionally done. And I would encourage people, if you're interested in the topic, it doesn't read like, oh, just a hodgepodge of stuff that he threw together. Like you just go through the table of contents and it's organized very logically and they all do fit together. And you went into, now, I don't know if you did this like in part of this process, but you really go through and footnote everything as well. So, I mean, it really is a good place besides just if someone wants to know what does Stephan Kinsella think about some topic. But if someone who's going to write a paper for the Journal of Libertarian Studies or some related thing on a topic that's in this book, your chapter is going to be a good source for a bunch of references to get you going.
Yeah, I think that one of my drawbacks and one of my skills is that I am sort of anally retentive about footnoting everything. And that's what you learn as a lawyer or a legal scholar. If you say the earth exists, you have to have a footnote for it. You can't just say it.
It's funny you say that. I literally today, earlier on Twitter, somebody retweeted, like it was that somebody had submitted something to a law review and they came back and wanted a cite because the person had said the sun emits light and planets reflect it. And they wanted a cite for that.
So. Right. And so it's a bizarre tactic or habit I picked up from being a lawyer. On the other hand, of course, courts will have what they call judicial notice. So they can like say, oh, you don't have to prove this. We will take what they call, quote, judicial notice of this fact, which means you can't challenge it. Like, oh, the Encyclopedia Britannica existed from this point in time, or the Earth is this many years old or whatever. We'll take judicial notice of it. But if you're like a budding scholar, you have to like prove everything. So if you're a lawyer, you want to prove everything with footnotes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So it's like, as you say, like in some context, maybe that's distracting to some readers, but for what you're doing in this book, I think it's very good and it's a definitive. Would you say, well, I'll say this and then you tell me if I'm leaving something out. I think if people understand what Rothbard did in the Ethics of Liberty in terms of, you know, where do we go just from scratch to build up this edifice of libertarian legal thinking, what would the law look like, or what should guide jurists in a free society in the sense of a Rothbardian flavor? And that's what his book was. I think yours is the next edition. Am I missing somebody?
Well, so the way I look at it, I think you're basically correct. So we have these canonical texts, right, which we base our theories on, like the Tannehills and even Ayn Rand and Rothbard and de Juvenal and these guys, Measley. So my approach has always been to build upon the thinking that influenced me, right?
Mm-hmm.
And to try to see where the opening is to advance a theory and to expand it and to clarify it. Hoppe, Rothbard, Mises, Hazlitt, other thinkers. Let's take the Tannehills, for example. They were like Randians trying to advance the theory. Can I stop?
You're talking about Linda and Morris Tannehill. I know the Market for Liberty was the book. Are you talking about just that, or did they write a bunch of other stuff that I don't know about?
Yeah, I'm talking about like that book. Okay. Like so for me and for like a lot of early libertarians. Mm-hmm. So there was a book by Morris and Linda Tannehill called The Market for Liberty, which was sort of like a synthesis of Randian, objectivist, and anarchist Rothbardian theories, which influenced a lot of people. Like, but the point is, there's a lot of books like this that have influenced people over the years. But my view is just like a budding libertarian was like, what do I like? And you and I have, I think we've had previous podcasts and disagreements about this before, like Hoppe's argumentation ethics and things like this. And I don't think we're going to probably get into this today, but I actually think there's a way you and I could have a synthesis and we can leave that for another day, maybe. But the point is,
we'll get more views if we fight. I'm just going to say that.
Well, we can fight if we take our shirts off and we put our gloves on and we do a Paul Krugman thing, I guess. what I think is okay. So I wrote a book, and the reason I wrote a book was because I over the years I developed a series of articles which I thought were consistent with each other, which were based upon and which clarified things in the libertarian theory and based upon Austrian economics. But what you could say is that, like someone like you and I could disagree on Austrian on argumentation ethics and the nature of rights.
Mm-hmm.
But the theory of it is that, like, if you think what drew me to this in the beginning, and it's not about me, Kinsella, but you can't help but be personal about it.
Right.
But what drew me to it was the consistency of the idea of if there's an idea of justice and you care about rights and justice, there's a reciprocity aspect to it, right? So that's the initial thing that appealed to me as a young college student, mm-hmm. right? Reading The Fountainhead, or even high school student reading The Fountainhead. Like, The Fountainhead, to me, Ayn Rand's The Fountainhead, which a lot of people think Ayn Rand is the beginning of the modern libertarian movement. And I think that's roughly correct. But I think that's because of her Atlas Shrugged and her Capitalism, The Unknown Ideal, and her other works. It's actually not because of Fountainhead, which is her earlier work, which was the one that made her more popular, which is what actually attracted me. So what's mm-hmm. ironic to me as a libertarian, and I'd like to get your input, your take on this. So I read The Fountainhead in 1982 or 1981 as a young 10th or 11th grade high school student, right? And I loved it because it was so individualist and in your face and whatever. But reading it now, and it made me a libertarian, by the way, it made me like read all the other stuff, like mm-hmm. Henry Hazlitt and Mises and Rothbard and the other stuff. But reading it now, I'm thinking like The Fountainhead is totally unlibertarian because Howard Roark is this weird narcissist character who wants to blow up projects because of intellectual property. And, you know, like the whole thing, like there's really nothing libertarian about The Fountainhead. Atlas Shrugged there is, but not mm-hmm. The Fountainhead. But it still somehow converted me. And I think it was because it made me, it appealed to my individualist instinct, like, screw you, I'm going to do what I want to do, you know, whatever, mm-hmm. whatever. So I'm curious what you think about The Fountainhead itself as the foundational layer of libertarianism.
Okay, I will answer that. But before I forget, let me just mention, because you talked about the Tannehills, and it's, I think a lot of people don't even know what that is. And
okay, that's correct.
Yeah, yeah, and so I stumbled upon it. And so what I did, I'm just going to say that just so it's at least the future AIs, when they're scanning the internet to be trained, they'll know this stuff. Not that humans are going to care. But so my booklet, Chaos Theory, that I wrote in grad school, what I was trying to do in that is, because I said, all right, there's three main texts in the anarcho-capitalist tradition. There's, you know, Rothbard's For a New Liberty, and that's taken clearly like a natural rights, natural law foundation for where rights come from and whatever, like, why is libertarianism a good thing? And this is why it would actually work. And then Friedman's Machinery of Freedom, which was very utilitarian in its grounding. And then the Linda and Morris Tannehill, The Market for Liberty, which was clearly objectivist. And so what I was trying to do is to say, instead of forcing the reader to choose and like having to sort yourself based on where you thought, you know, why you thought property rights were good, couldn't I write something that kind of distills it so it doesn't take a stand on that stuff? Because I thought I could get away with, most people are okay with not having war, not having sadistic prison guards beating people up, and people having more food and housing, and, you know, like, you get what I'm saying. And if we didn't have to have taxes and could still have all that nice stuff and have roads and schools, wouldn't that be great? So that's what I was trying to do with it. So those are the three things. As far as The Fountainhead, full confession, I have never read in terms of the physical books. My roommate and I in college, undergrad, got into Ayn Rand, and we were in the car a lot driving around, and we listened to them like on road trips, The Fountainhead and Atlas Shrugged, like on tape. And so Roark, he's the architect, right? Like, that's the fact that I'm asking you, right? And is it Reardon Metals is in Atlas Shrugged? Is that the two?
Yes, that's interesting. So, yeah, Reardon Metals is what the is one of the inventions of Hank Reardon, right? And Atlas Shrugged. Yes,
okay. And he's so, the guy originally who thinks John Galt is a monster, and then later realizes he's cool. in Atlas
Shrugged? Something like that.
Yeah.
Yeah, something like that. Yeah.
Okay, that's so interesting. Just the fact that I'm asking, right, it's like if I said, Luke Skywalker, is he the guy that has the sword or the blaster? Right. Like, you'd realize, oh, this guy doesn't, he's not a Star Wars geek.
No, so it's interesting that even mm-hmm. that you're as close as to me as you are, is that you're like, kind of like, I don't know all these guys. Like, so that apparently influenced me way more than it influenced you.
Oh yeah, so totally. Like, so I, just real fast, so I, in high school, junior high, my dad was listening to Rush Limbaugh on the radio. That's what got me interested in what was called conservatism. And then that got me, he got this thing called the Conservative Chronicle, and that had columnists like Cale Thomas and Mona Cheren and people like that. But they also had Walter Williams and Thomas Sowell. And then I realized, oh, those are my favorite. And then I realized, oh, I'm not conservative, I'm libertarian. And then I got Henry Hazlitt's Economics in One Lesson. And then he talked about Mises. And then I got Human Action and some Rothbard stuff. So I was an Austrian economist, minarchist going into undergrad, and then I became an ANCAP freshman. And yeah, I think I was a full-blown ANCAP who wanted to be a college professor teaching Austrian economics for my career before I even read on tape anything from Ayn Rand.
Well, let me ask you, have you ever read Jerome Cicilli's book, It Usually Begins with Ayn Rand?
No, I've heard of it, of course, but no, I've never read it.
Okay, well, I won't say you need to read, you wouldn't need to read A, B, and C, but that's the one book that you should read because it's really funny. It's a hilarious depiction of the late 1970s, early 1980s libertarian movement and why the Ayn Rand movement was an influential entree. So the way I look at libertarianism is, I mean, from my perspective and mm-hmm. from looking at it from the outside, I think libertarianism, of course, you can say came from the classical liberals and the conservatives and the radical liberals of the past, you know. But really, the modern libertarian movement, yeah, you could say came from Ayn Rand and Rose Roger Lane and Isabel Patterson. And then the later writers, Henry Hazlitt and Rothbard and all these guys, Milton Friedman. That's true. And there's no like fundamental, like final thing. But I do think that the market for liberty, I actually think, there's so many books you could say are the main ones, right? Mm-hmm. But The Fountainhead really like made people think about things in a certain way. And then, you know, Atlas Shrugged in another way. And if you come into it from another direction, you don't even see that, right? So that's the thing. You don't even see it. And so people like me who come in from one direction, we lose sight of the fact. So I think that basically the big entree into the libertarian movement in the beginning was basically Ayn Rand. And then mm-hmm. all of her followers and people were influenced by her. But the second way was Ron Paul, right? So I think the Ron Paul movement, the late 1980s or whenever he ran for president, the time that mattered, I can't even remember. So you have the Ron Paul movement and then the Ayn Rand movement. And the good thing about the Ron Paul movement was it expanded the numbers by a factor of, I don't know, 8 or something or 10. But it also, in a way, dumbed us down because you had these people and then the internet was coming up and people became the types of people that didn't learn things from reading books, but from podcasts and from YouTube videos and whatever. Mm-hmm. So in a weird way, the libertarian movement became bigger and broader and even more radical because of Ron Paul and Austrian economics, right? Because before that, the libertarian movement was, you know, more minarchist and more moderate. Mm-hmm. But after Ron Paul, it became way more Austrian and more radical and more open to anarchist ideas. But they weren't the types that were reading books. And so you got this expansion of the movement, but a reduction in, I won't say IQ, but like a reduction in sort of intellectualism, right?
Yeah, great word. I know exactly what you're trying to say, because it's not that they're stupid.
I'm not sure that's good or bad.
Yeah, yeah. Right. So it's not that that we're saying like the average libertarian now compared to like the year 2000 is dumber. That's not the claim, but it's like they don't care as much about ideas. Like some of them would even actively go ahead.
Or they haven't learned their ideas from reading books. They've learned it from podcasts and from other things. And I think there's nothing wrong with that. That's perfectly fine. But it's a different way of absorbing information and coming up with theories about the world. So I think the libertarian movement has gotten bigger and even more radical in a sense because of Ron Paul. So I think that Ayn Rand and Ron Paul were the two biggest influences. That's the way I see it. But that's just my perspective on it from my little perch.
Okay. Yeah, I noticed too, we're a little bit spoiled at the Mises Institute because, of course, you know, the new crop of kids who have been reading Rothbard and Man Economy or Human Action or whatever since they were in junior high, they show up down there. And so that's what we see. But yeah, I think over time too, there's a lot of people who are even anarcho-capitalists in the Rothbardian vein who may not really know much free market economics. Like if you said to them, you know, what determines the minimum or what determines wage rates or something, they, you know, I mean, they might just say, oh, voluntary trade or something, but they wouldn't know much more. Not that there's anything wrong with that, as Seinfeld would say. I'm just noting the fact that they used to be more all coming via Austrian economics. And then now it's, you know, somebody's a fan of somebody's podcast and that's what got them into it. Or like you say, they were following the Ron Paul movement because they want to, you know, end the Fed and bring the troops home or something. That's cool. And dealing with the Fed, it does involve monetary stuff, but still, I could just see from the Discord, like even a lot of people who are like, quote, on my side on an issue, if they jump in on something, they're arguing with some lefty, they start losing little points here and there in the debate because they just don't know standard economics. And so, you know, if the lefty's somewhat more trained in that, then they can sit there and, you know, take pot shots at sort of like a lefty on some climate science issues might look better compared to the outside observer. You know, if he's going against somebody who's like a Glenn Beck fan, even if you and I probably agree in spirit with the Glenn Beck fan that, you know, so anyway, partly what I like about your book here though, is because of your legal training, like all the people we've talked about, the Tannehills, Rothbard, you know, David Friedman, people like him, none of them was an actual practicing lawyer, whereas you are. And so that does give you a bit more authenticity and like just being able to take the libertarian ideas and express them and then contrast them with, you know, in the real world, if you go before a judge, this is what is going to happen. And like, just, you know, the vocabulary and so forth.
Yes. I mean, in my view, and so, yeah, being a lawyer is not always a popular thing to say, right? But there's nothing wrong with legal science. Like, you know, the Austrians talk about economic science, and that's not a popular or a conventional way to describe economics. But we Austrians think of economics as an economic science, right? Mm-hmm. I think the law can be a legal science in a sense, but you have to, you know, be careful about it. And so let's take an example. In my book, chapter 9 on contract theory, in my view, Murray Rothbard in 1974 came up with a revolutionary idea about how to think about what contract is, like what contracting is. Mm-hmm. And then Williams and Evers took that and expanded upon it. And then Rothbard built on that in his Ethics of Liberty in 1978, 82, whenever it was. But the point is, two social theorists, economists, social theorists, neither of them lawyers, Williams and Evers and Rothbard, came up with what I think is a revolutionary transformation of the way we should consider in the law what contract is. Now, I do think they made a few mistakes, which is natural because they weren't lawyers and they weren't deep legal scholars. And that's what I built on in my work. And I tried to like say, hey, let's take Rothbard and Evers and build on that and explain a better way to look at contract theory, which helps to explain property theory and things like intellectual property, right? So there's a lot of insights there. So what I've tried to do in my little minor career in this is recognize what I have to offer and to understand the basics of Austrian economics, property theory, basic of economics, and legal theory and law, and use that to add to the edifice as I could. And so like that's one example. And so I think that the title transfer theory of contract, which I'm talking about now, is an advance on the legal theory and the way the law ought to treat contracts. And it helps explain lots of things about property rights. But that's because we understand that Rothbard himself and Evers, you know, contributed something we can build on.
Okay. Can you, this is a really good example. So can you just elaborate on that a little bit? Like, what was Rothbard's innovation? And then what was the content? Like, what were people doing out in the wild before he came up with that? And then what were the problems with it?
Yeah. Yeah. So this is something that's, it's fairly subtle and it's hard to explain unless you have a certain attention span. But I think basically, Rothbard observed that there was a problem with the conventional theory of contract law. Okay, this seemed like a boring topic, but it's not boring because it matters, because we live in a world of law, and law is ultimately property rights, and the law ultimately decides who owns what, and that's affected by contract law, like who can transfer what in this system, right? So property law and contract law are basic and fundamental, and they matter. And so what Rothbard noticed was that there is a problem in, not in property law so much. So property law basically is like everyone owns scarce resources according to certain principles. I mean, roughly, except for the statist part, right? Because the state is announcing these things and the state gets to decide and they can make exceptions. But the rough principle is people own things according to original appropriation or Lockean homesteading or by contract. But what does that mean, right? So contract is a big part of that. So in other words, when there's a resource under dispute, who owns it? And the answer would, in a simple society, would be, okay, the guy that got it first or the guy he gave it to. I mean, to put it simply. But that the second part is a contract part. But the way the law has developed in the last several hundred years is that the contract is conceived of as a promise made by a person to do something, to do some action. And then if you have certain formalities associated with it, like consideration, which means you give a little something for it, or you, the other side gives a little something for it, then it's called binding. So you have a binding or enforceable obligation, an enforceable promise or an enforceable obligation. So that's how people think of promises and contracts now. Is a contract is something someone says that is binding and the other person can rely on it. And then if you don't do it, you're in breach of contract and you have to pay damages. Like, that's the conventional way of looking at it. And there's a lot of problems with that theory. which are not pertinent here. But Rothbard and Evers said, instead of looking at contract as a promise that you say that is a binding, that results in a binding obligation under the law, mm-hmm. which means that if you don't perform it, you are in breach and then you owe damages. Instead, we should look at contracts as simply the exercise by the owner of an object to sell it or give it to someone else or not, right? In other words, that's why they call it the title transfer theory of contract. And I actually think this is one of Rothbard, I think this is Rothbard's greatest contribution to political philosophy, is this revolutionary transformation of the conception of what contract is. It should be viewed as the exercise by the owner of a resource of who owns it. And you can do this in different sophisticated ways. And of course, lawyers can help you think of clever ways to word these title transfers. They could be conditional, they can be future-based or whatever. And you could end up with a very similar situation to what we have now, but there would be some differences. And the theory would be more sound and would be more elegant. Let's take an example.
Can I stop you for a second? Let me make two statements, and then you tell me if they're right, and then you can go ahead. So the default was, before Rothbard wrote, and then to the extent that the legal profession continued along without caring much about what some guy Murray Rothbard wrote and his disciples, is what contracts are. Like, if you step back and like, what is this, man? It's like, oh, they're codified promises that are legally binding. That's what a contract is. And then a subset of possible contracts involves the transfer of titles. And when Rothbard says, no, contracts per se, what are they? They are about the formal transfer of titles, which are, you know, claims of ownership on scarce items. And it doesn't even, if there was a purported contract that did not involve merely a promise, but did involve title transfer, it certainly wouldn't be an enforceable contract in a just society. And whether you want to call it a contract or not is kind of a moot point, but it's certainly not anything that's legally enforceable. Are those true statements?
Right.
Okay.
I think that's roughly right. I think that Rothbard's formulation would have been mostly right, but he didn't get it quite right. But I mean, he was pioneering a new transformation Western.
You're saying my paraphrase was pretty much right, but then you're saying what I accurately paraphrased is Rothbard's view. Rothbard's view was not quite right.
I think your paraphrase is mostly right, but okay. What I think I did was another paraphrase of Rothbard. And so for example, Rothbard, he glimpsed the essential problem, which was that promising, which is saying words, doesn't bind you. Mm-hmm. But because he wasn't quite a complete comprehensive legal scholar, he mangled a few things. So for example, Rothbard said that, okay, if you promise something that doesn't result in a binding obligation, but if you have a loan contract, let's say, for example, like where A promises to pay $1,000 to, well, let's not even say promises. A gives $1,000 to B now as a loan, and then mm-hmm. B promises to pay $1,100.
Well, you just use promise which would again. Be, you want to say he sells him a claim?
I mean, this is the problem. So this is part of the problem with Rothbard's analysis. He says that if you use the word promise, then it's nugatory. And I'm like, well, the thing is, a contract really is simply the exercise of an owner over his own resource. And you can let someone use it temporarily, permanently, or whatever, by manifesting your consent, because you're the owner. So you can let someone use your hut or your Airbnb or your car, or you can sell it to them forever, or you can give it to them. Like, there's different ways you can do things, right? Or you can make it conditional upon them doing some action or some other title transfer. There's any number of ways people can have their, you know, their interactions, right? But the point is, all these things are done by a communication of by the owner. You have to manifest your consent. And so, sure, if I say you can use my car to go to Burning Man for the weekend, but that consent doesn't mean you can burn the car, right? Or sell it. Like, it's limited. It's so, so at that point in time, it's a joint title transfer. So all these things come down to practical considerations of who owns what at a given point in time.
Hey folks, let's take a break from the action to talk about our sponsor for today, Monetary Metals. Now, we all know the dollar's losing value because of inflation, and we all know that owning gold protects your wealth from eroding away. But one of the biggest objections to owning gold is that it just sits there. There's no yield. It doesn't pay you any interest or dividends. In fact, you have to pay fees to store and insure it. But what if you could actually earn interest on gold? Well, that's exactly what Monetary Metals offers. With Monetary Metals, you can earn between 2% to 5% on your gold and silver every year. And if you're an accredited investor, you're eligible to earn even higher yields. But how does it work? How are they able to pay interest on gold? And let me say, folks, this part of their business model, it took me a bit to understand. After all, I thought, it's not like physical gold bars turn into more gold bars a year later. So how could they reliably promise you a return denominated in physical gold? Well, here's how it works. Monetary Metals connects you and your ounces with companies that need physical gold inventory for their business, such as jewelers, mints, refineries, bullion dealers, and more. The businesses need gold, and Monetary Metals lets you rent your gold to these qualified businesses. Now, in a more conventional arrangement, a jeweler, for example, might buy raw gold at its market price, fashion it into necklaces, rings, and so on, and then down the road sell the finished products. But this more conventional model involves risk for the jeweler because the price of gold can drop in the interim, meaning they won't be able to sell the necklaces, rings, and so on for what they originally forecasted. If they had relied on a loan quoted in dollars to finance their initial purchase of the raw gold, they might be unable to pay back their creditors. But with Monetary Metals on the scene, there's another option. Now these businesses get the gold they need to use in their own business without being exposed to gold price risk. The jeweler, for example, borrows the raw gold at the start and promises a markup in physical gold. Then, no matter what happens to the spot price of gold, the jeweler's built-in margin from transforming raw gold into earrings, rings, and so on, kicks in and allows him to pay back his loan after the final sale. The jeweler benefits, and you get to put your gold to work for a regularly monthly income in gold. It's a win-win. Now, when I say interest on gold, paid in gold, I mean it. It's actually paid in ounces of gold. For example, let's say you start out with 100 ounces and the interest rate is 3% annual. That means you will be earning 3 additional ounces of gold every year, regardless of what the spot price of gold does during the year. You just watch your total gold ounces grow every month and leverage the power of compound interest, but measured in ounces of physical gold and silver. So let's recap. Why would you earn interest in dollars, which are constantly losing value, when you can earn interest in gold? Go to www.monetary-metals.com/Murphy to learn more or to get started opening an account. In case you're wondering, I've opened an account with them myself, and my gold is now growing more gold at Monetary Metals. So again, go to monetary-metals.com/Murphy to get started growing your gold too. Okay, let's get back to the show.
Okay. Maybe it would help the viewer. He walks through, it's something like if the movie studio hires an actor, and the actor says, "Oh yes, I'm, you know, I promise I will, you know, be the star in this film and I'll show up on set 6 months from now on location," and and then the actor gets a better offer and doesn't show up. Doesn't Rothbard have a thing where the studio can't sue him for damages? Like they could have asked him to post a bond and they can blacklist him and stuff like that. But strictly speaking, because that would be like slavery. Do you know what I'm talking about? Where he's trying to show how a promise is not an enforceable claim on somebody.
Right. So, to untangle. So let me make clear that I'm saying that I think Rothbard came up with a revolutionary way to understand what contracts are based upon his fundamental understanding of property rights. Mm-hmm. I think he made a few mistakes in his own interpretation of it, which is not to criticize him. I mean, he was coming up with what I think is one of the most revolutionary theories of all time. But I think, so his mistake was, so number one, he thought that if you have the loan contract, for example, he thought of it like A pays $1,000 to B in exchange for $1,100 in a year from B, right? So what he said was that if B doesn't repay the $1,100, then he's a thief. And mm-hmm. theoretically, if you're a thief, then you're an aggressor. And theoretically, you know, you could be punished for that. So right. theoretically, debtor's prison could be justified if mm-hmm. you don't repay a debt.
Just as surely as if he just pickpocketed the guy and the guy had $1,100 on him a year from now, he just took it out of his wallet in that sense.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. Except it's not just as surely because there's a difference between now and then, right? And so the point is, what Rothbard said was, yeah, theoretically you're a thief, and he called it some weird term called implicit theft. He said it's an act of implicit theft.
Mm-hmm.
Because he knew that it wasn't really theft, because you can't steal something that doesn't exist. Like if there's a debtor who owes money and he's penniless and he can't repay the debt, what's he stealing, right? So this is the fundamental, and I'm not sure, I don't think you disagree with me on this, I'm not sure, but Walter Block and Rothbard, well, Walter Block disagrees with me on this. I don't think Rothbard would disagree with me if he had lived to hear this explanation, but he had some confusions in his own theory, right? Like mm-hmm. Rothbard A versus B disagree with each right. other.
By the way, I think the same thing with time preference. I think if you just locked me in a room with Rothbard for a week, we would come out and he would be like, yeah, he cleared up my thinking on time preference, but go ahead.
No, and that might be true. And I'm not trying to be a Rothbard like a hero worshiper. I literally believe that if Rothbard had lived 10 more years, he would have agreed with me on intellectual property. I think so too.
Yeah.
Little doubt about that. And probably on these on the things that are basically inconsistencies between his own theories. Like I think there are inconsistencies between his own theories in contract law and his views on inalienability. So for example, here's what Rothbard said. So Rothbard came up with this great, complete revolution in contract theory, which I am writing an article on in David Howden's new book on the Palgrave book on this, which was, and Williams and Evers picked up on. But by the way, Rothbard and Evers are not lawyers. And so, yeah, they missed a few legal details. Okay, that's fine. But basically, they made a great contribution, but Rothbard missed a few points. So Rothbard said, okay, I recognize that if you make a promise, well, we have to back up a little. Let's back up a little bit. Okay. In the law, the reason that the lawyers and the judges say that a contract is binding is because if you say words, I promise to do this, I will do this, then other people will rely upon it. And if they rely upon it to their detriment, this is why we call detrimental reliance, right? That's the whole theory. Then if you don't perform, then they're harmed, right? So that's the whole theory. But if you just think about it for a second, that whole theory makes no sense, because you don't have the right to rely on a promise unless it's reasonable to rely upon it. And it's only reasonable to rely upon it if the law enforces that. In other words, you know, if someone says something, it's up to you, like caveat emptor, like if someone says something, it's up to you. Like it doesn't make any sense to back it up. And the law is replete with these critiques of the arguments in favor of reliance.
Can I stop you? Stop trying, just so the listener gets it. So like, I don't know. If some guy thinks he's Don Juan, he's walking around, he says, ladies, if you go out on a date with me, I'll show you the time of your life. It would be crazy if a woman went on a date with him and then tried to sue him saying, I didn't have the time of my life. That everybody would know that clearly wasn't a legally enforceable claim that he was making. That's kind of an exaggerated, silly example, but is that?
It's close. I think that would be more about the definitiveness of the terms. Like, yeah, it's just like it's too vague of a term to even be a contract. I mean, contract law. So this is the point. Contract law provides for all these things. It would already not enforce that contract because
there's multiple things wrong with what that guy for that lady trying to sue that guy.
It's not meaningful. But the point Rothbard was making is that if you say the words "I promise to do something," you're not really harming someone. And so I guess the point is, it's just the recognition that if the law is going to come in and force you to do something, there has to be a reason, right? Mm-hmm. And unless you did something, like if I harmed you, if I stole your car or your ox, or if I stabbed you in the neck, okay, I've done something objective that can be proved, and I owe you restitution or rectification, right? That's what the law is there for, like to provide a remedy. But if we believe in free speech, and if I say, hey, Bob, I think I'm going to date your sister, and then I don't date her, I just made a claim. I just said words.
Right, right.
So normally saying words is not an act of aggression. So then we come down to the Rothbard-Evers view that, well, if you're an owner of resources, what does it mean to own a resource? And how do you come to own resources? They don't go into this a lot. Rothbard does to a degree in some of his writing. But the libertarian, the Lockean, the natural law tradition is that, okay, we own resources, scarce resources in the world, because we homestead them. That means they were unowned, and we're the first ones to use them and transform them and establish some connection to them, right? Or we get them from a previous owner. That's what contract is. So contract is simply the exercise of ownership of an owner of a resource to transfer to someone else. So that's the Rothbard contribution.
Can I jump in?
It seems
real fast here.
Sure, go ahead.
Because I'm having like a mini epiphany where, and maybe this is even how Rothbard stumbled upon it, as opposed to just being some, wow, he just was so productive. It seems to me, back a minute ago when you were talking about harming someone, because right, colloquially, there's all sorts of way, like you could, you know, go up and tease somebody and that could harm him, you know, in a colloquial sense, like maybe, you know, sticks and stones and whatever, like, you know, in some cases, I'd much rather somebody punched me than, you know, said some hateful things about me or whatever. And then even, you know, I could open a business across the street from yours and put you out of business. But most, you know, libertarian types would certainly in a Rothbard tradition would say you didn't harm him in some, you know, actionable sense. And so what, and ultimately all these cases, it boils down to, well, if you didn't violate his property rights, then, you know, you didn't do anything that the law can step in and stop you from what you're doing. Like, so it all kind of boils back to, did you violate someone's property rights? Whereas the examples you gave, you go and steal something out of someone's wallet or you punch them or whatever. clearly you are violating their property rights. And so is that probably how Rothbard came to this view that ultimately the only way the law is going to come in and punish me for contract violation is if really it can be equivalent to I violated that guy's property rights?
I don't know how he came to this insight. I think it's a brilliant insight. I think it may be that. I think it might have been his focus on what property rights are. But I think what he recognized was that merely promising wasn't enough. Maybe he saw a problem in the traditional justification for property rights theory, sort of contract law theory, which was the detrimental reliance view, which was that if you rely upon someone's promise to your detriment and you're harmed, then you have a cause of action. And he saw that that was a circular argument because all the theories say that you have to reasonably rely upon a promise. And so it's only reasonable if the law enforces it. So the whole thing is circular. So he realized it. And plus he realized that the free speech thing, like, you know, if you shout fire in a crowded theater, or if you say A, B, and C, why does just saying something matter? Right. So I think he recognized that mere words by themselves are not aggression. And basically libertarianism is centered on aggression. And so I think that's what gave him the insight for this, but it was a brilliant insight in any case. It wasn't flawless, as I said, because he thought that it would lead to, in principle, debtor's prison if you don't repay your debt. And he sensed that, and I think he was wrong about that. I can explain why, but I think he was wrong about that. But he sensed that debtor's prison, which was an implication of his view of implicit theft, which, by the way, I think this idea of implicit theft is not part of his original reformation of contract law. But he thought, okay, if you don't repay the debt, you're an implicit thief. Mm-hmm. So if you're a thief, you can go to prison. But then he recognized that he had written elsewhere that human rights are inalienable, and like you can't sell yourself into slavery. Okay, if you can't sell yourself into slavery, then failure to repay a debt can't result in debtor's prison, because that would be the same thing, right, as selling yourself into slavery. So his solution to his own dilemma that he created with his own confusion of his own theories was, well, punishing someone with debtor's prison for not paying a debt would be disproportionate. And we believe in proportionality, right, of punishment. I think that's an unsatisfying. I don't think he needed to. He doesn't need to rescue his theory, because his theory doesn't lead to what he thinks it leads to, is my point.
Okay.
And I sound like I'm being a Rothbard critic here, but honestly, I don't want to sound like that, because his contract theory, I think, is an amazing contribution to political philosophy and to legal theory. I think it could be burnished up a little bit and tweaked in a few ways, which I've tried to do. But I think Rothbard was right in thinking and arguing that you cannot alienate your rights as a human being, like by contract. You can't promise to be a slave, and then the slave owner can use force against you to keep you to be a slave. He was right about that. His arguments were a little shaky, but they're roughly right. Right. Mm-hmm. I think he was right in saying what he said about the way contracts should be viewed as title transfers instead of binding promises. So I don't have to say other than that I think he did an amazing service for humanity in what he came up with.
Yeah, I don't think you came off as a critic. I think it's like if we're two physicists talking about Einstein famously put in the cosmological constant when he did general relativity because he was worried about
the implications, and you know, and then people, you know, think later refer to his greatest blunder. The reason we're sitting here spending an hour talking about this guy in the little view is because we think he's, you know, was so important and a genius. Just real quickly, so why? It totally made sense. I was tracking that if Rothbard's thinking of it, okay, so technically what's happening with a loan contract, it's not just that, oh, I promise I will pay you $1,100 next year, and then if I don't, uh-oh, I'm in trouble with the law now because I violated my promise. That it's more, no, in a sense, you know, in terms of economics, I gave you back then the present goods of $1,000, and you gave me a claim on a future good of $1,100, and then when that came due, here's my claim on a future good of $1,100 that's now ripening into a present good of $1,100. And if you don't give it to me, it's as if you stole $1,100, which at that point is a present good from me. And just like if you had taken $1,100 from me at gunpoint out of my wallet, I could go to jail. In principle,
To me, it's the as if that's the problem here. So as if is fine if you want to have a metaphor to describe things. So, for example, if you want to describe taxation as a theft of my time, you can characterize it that way, right? You can say that the taxation on me is a theft of my time because, you know, if I work 60 hours a week and the government takes one third of it, then it's as if they're taking one third of my time. So I guess you could call it the theft of 20 hours a week, but that's a metaphor. It's like, it's not literally true. Like you don't really own your time. And so it's not that the as if part, the as if part helps illustrate the problems with the consequences of state or private crime. But I don't think it's literally always true. And I think we can get misled by that sometimes. Right. So the as if part is part of the problem. So that's why I think I go to literalism, and sometimes people are annoyed by that. So let's say, for example, you and I both agree that if the government, if the state, let's say again, another bad word, the state, not the government, if the state has an agency called the Federal Reserve or the Central Bank that prints money, and it causes inflation. Now, we often call that theft, but it's not. It's like it's as if theft, as you said.
Right,
It's like theft. What I would say is that there's an act of aggression, and the consequence of it is to impoverish people. And one way we can describe it is by analogizing it to, let's say, theft. So every day that the money you have in your bank account can buy less goods. Now, did the government literally steal something from your bank account? No. But what they did was they committed an act of aggression by forcing people with the threat of force to go along with this fiat money system that allows them to print more dollars, which allows, you know, more money to come into the system, which ends up with the dollars that you hold in your bank account being able to purchase less, right? So the consequences are similar to what would happen if you were stolen from with a tax. So, yeah, as economists, we can say inflation is a tax, but it's not actually a tax. It's just a way of describing the way it works, I think. Does that make sense?
Yes. It makes sense. In the interest of brevity here, because I got about 25 minutes and I have a hard stop. I think maybe we should jump into IP, because that's you know, where you certainly have made the biggest contribution. So can you maybe first just real quick give the, like, what happened? Were you just slowly over time feeling uneasy about it, and then you realize there's something odd and it doesn't quite fit, and at first, did you want to just start chipping away at it, or did you realize pretty early on that, no, this thing is completely wrong and we got to
blow it up? Let me give you two quick explanations. Okay. So one would be from say, chronological from my point of view. So one was as a budding libertarian who had an interest in justice and property rights and all that stuff. And I was dissatisfied with the arguments I heard for IP, which were, I say, Ayn Rand's. And the reason is they were all utilitarian, or they were all like, oh, here's a reason why you can have a 17-year term for copyrights. I'm sorry, patents, and 150-year term for copyrights. And thinking like in terms of principles and natural law, I thought there's something wrong with an argument that says 17 years is the right term, because you know that's not the right term.
Right, right.
And then you think there's not a right term. And like there's something wrong if you think that there's a property right that expires after a certain arbitrary term that the state decrees. So something was fishy to me about it. I think in more principled terms, the best way to think about it, and this will annoy lots of people, but this is the only way I have come to think about it and can think about it, is that you have to think in fundamental terms about the reason and the nature and the function of property rights. Mm-hmm. And that is that we are human beings, and we each have our own finite, scarce body, which lives on a finite, scarce world. And we live in a world of scarce, finite resources. That's just the way it is. And, you know, if that's the premise of my argument, if you want to deny that, then okay, you're on another planet. Okay. I don't think that's assailable. And given that, and given, honestly, Misesian praxeology and a few basic economic concepts. So Mises' praxeology is the idea that every human being is an actor and they pursue goals, right? Mm-hmm. Or as you would say, by choice. And they employ scarce resources or means, Mises calls them means, to achieve goals or ends. But one thing that I do think is insufficiently highlighted in the Austrian literature, is recognized, but it's not highlighted enough, is that to have a successful human action, you have to aim at a goal, acquire scarce means to achieve it, and act to do it. Right? But it's guided by knowledge. Knowledge. And so, to my mind, the two essential ingredients of successful human action are knowledge and access to means. So you use and manipulate means, but it's guided by knowledge. Mm-hmm. This is inherent to praxeology, because you can't imagine a human action that's successful unless the human actor that's doing what he's doing is being guided by some ideas or knowledge about the way things work in the world. That's how he decides what ends to pursue and what means to use to pursue those ends, right? So you have to have knowledge and access to scarce resources. And the purpose of property rights is to allocate these scarce resources so that they can be used productively and cooperatively among people instead of being fought over because they're scarce. But that concern makes no sense with regard to ideas or information. So to my mind, honestly, Mises and praxeology, although Mises himself never quite saw this, I think, shows why intellectual property can never make any sense, because intellectual property is an attempt to provide property rights over the knowledge that guides action, right? What Rothbard would call recipes. But I think you have to recognize that this is impossible. It's not just that I disagree with it or think it's illegitimate or immoral. It's just literally impossible. You literally cannot have property rights in information. You can only have property rights in physical, tangible, corporeal, material, scarce resources, because property rights are always enforceable. And the word force is part of this definition for a reason. Force is a physical, another physical, corporeal thing. Force can only be used against physical things. It's like the physics definition of force. Mm-hmm. You can only push against a physical thing. You can't push against a ghost. You know what I mean? And mm-hmm. so, or an idea. And so when we talk about law and rights and force, we're talking about corporeal, tangible, material, physical things. That's the only thing law can be applied to. So when we say there's a property right in A or B or C, and so, for example, in the case of copyright or patent law, which is the two primary sources of types of IP law, what we're saying is that the government assigns the owner of a copyright to A or the owner of a patent to A, and that gives them the right to go to a government court to use physical corporeal force against what? Against the physical assets of a physical corporeal person. It's never against an idea or a pattern of information. So if I have a copyright, I can stop you from printing a book. And if you do it, I can take your money from your bank account using government force. Or if I have a patent on an invention, I can stop you from using your factory to make this new device. And if you do, I can take it from you or destroy it or get the government courts to take some of your money from your bank account. Like, it's always really about this. It's where the rubber hits the road. Make sense?
Right. Yeah. So let me just, and I remember when I read your against IP essay, like that was the part that was really where it was really clicking with me. And then of course, and that's why I want to get in just to have you answer some immediate objections that people have. But in terms of the essence of the theory, where it really clicked was, yeah, that like to say I own my car, hey, that thing over there, that's my car. What does that mean? Well, if somebody else tries to break into it, I can use force to push them away. Hey, take your hands off my car, buddy. That's my car. But to say, I wrote the McDonald's logo on my car and I better not see anybody else driving around town with that logo on their car, even I just said on their car, because that's stealing the logo and that's copyright protected, then when someone goes to do it, like it's, they can buy the paint can, they can be their vehicle. We all stipulate those facts. And then if the pattern in which they're using what is clearly their property corresponds to mine in some way, and it's only in a subset of things, like there's only then, oh, you've got copyright violation. And then we come in, you know, it's not take your hands off my property. It's stop using your property in a way that in some abstract sense corresponds sufficiently close to the way I use my property. And it's just, it's weird when you start thinking through what actually the claim is being right. made. And then also too, to say like, could Einstein have patented E equals MC squared? Like that's, you just realize how insane that would be, like how hard it would be to try to enforce that and just how much that would hamper human progress and how stupid that would be.
Right. And not to mention that Einstein was totally wrong about that. Just joking.
Okay. Well, it was bourgeois
physics. He was
wrong
about other things, but yeah. That E equals MC squared is apparently true, and he wasn't the first one to come up with it, right?
Oh, I don't even know. Are you saying there were people say that, you know, we attribute that to him, but actually there's precursors to everything, right? So that wouldn't surprise me, but no.
No. There were earlier proofs of that equation. Okay. No, I'm actually criticizing some of his later relativity views. But yeah, no, that one apparently is true. But yeah, that's the point. Patent law doesn't allow you to get a protection for what they call abstract or scientific or basic laws of the universe or something. It's like, well, why not? I mean, it takes human ingenuity to figure out the Pythagorean theorem or whatever, you know.
And you could use the same arguments. Well, gee, now there's not going to be as much discovery in that area, and you're stymieing progress. Why should mathematicians sit around and come up with new theorems if they can't patent it or copyright it or whatever? Which is what they say.
That's part of the problem with the IP argument is that like the arguments in favor of IP are never coherent and they're all over the map. Mm-hmm. So they'll flip back and forth between. So just to clarify for the listeners, you could say there are three basic theories in favor of the idea that you should be able to own what these ideal objects or these intellectual objects. One is the natural law theory that if you create something, you should be able to own it. Okay. If mm-hmm. I write a poem or a song, I created it, and so I should be able to own it. Okay, that's kind of the simplistic argument for that. The other is the utilitarian argument, which is that if the government doesn't incentivize people to do this, they won't do it. And we need this done, so we have to do it. Mm-hmm. Right? And then the third is this obscure argument, which is that it's called the personality theory, which is that like if you create an idea as part of your personality and you own yourself, and so you own this extension of yourself, that that one no one seems to understand. But let's just talk about the first two. Like, so the utilitarian argument, right? Like, it's obviously false. And what it's not only obviously false, it's obviously false that we don't need state intervention to incentivize research. Otherwise, there would be no research or even a lot of research. I mean, obviously, we know that's not the case. And we don't have any evidence that state intervention increases the amount of research. And the final point is we don't have any evidence that the state intervention and research increases the amount of research to a value amount that's better, that's greater than what the state had to spend to do it, right? Right. In other words, that it's greater than the cost. Like, no one has ever even tried to prove this. It's all ridiculous. Now, the creation argument is based upon a confusion, again, between economics and law or justice. It's really hard to understand this, but it's not that hard to understand. It's just hard to pay attention, I guess. But the basis of property rights and the basis of economic wealth are different things. And these are different economic realms of analysis. And so what I would say is this. Normative things, legal things, rights things, what people should have. We can have a good argument that we should have a society where we all want to live together and have division of labor, free trade, interaction, harmony, cooperation. And the way to do that, because we understand a little bit about economics, because Henry Hazlitt explained it to us all a long time ago, right? Is to simply have property rights allocated in a couple of basic ways. And one way is the first person who can use something gets it. That's called homesteading or original appropriation. And the second is contract, which we talked about earlier. Like, you can transfer it by contract. Those two things by themselves, there's a third, which I won't get into here, rectification for torts, but basically, you can identify any source of dispute. When people have a dispute over a resource, you can identify who the owner is by asking who got it first or who gave it to someone else by contract. It's really simple, right? Mm-hmm. That's political theory and law and rights. Economics talks about where wealth comes from. And where wealth comes from is human ingenuity taking the resources of nature and transforming them and making them more valuable to themselves or to their customers. That's what wealth is. And that presupposes, I guess, I assume, in an advanced division of labor society, it presupposes property rights that I just mentioned. But when you transform a resource with your intellect and your labor and your mental effort and the motions of your body, you do make wealth. You create wealth. Because if I take raw materials like iron ore and I make it into, I don't know, a plow or a harness for an ox or something, mm-hmm. I've now taken what I owned already and I've made it more valuable. And that's where economics come into play. So, and then I can trade it with people, and then economics, the higher level economics comes into play. But the economic aspect of it plays into the creation of wealth. But wealth is not something that you own. This is the point people miss. I think in the older days, when before the digital age and the information age, everything was tied to physical analog resources. And so, yes, in the older days, if you worked hard, you tended to be more prosperous. So there was a correlation between effort and work, and even the creation of wealth and property. They all kind of integrated together, right? But it doesn't mean that if you create something with your effort that you own it. And by the way, the easy way to understand this is to understand the fallacy of Marxian economics. My view is that John Locke made a mistake in his argument. Like, I think John Locke was right that if you use your human body and your effort and your labor and your creativity to find a thing in the field that's unowned, and you transform it with your labor and you mix your labor with it, as he called, mm-hmm. I think he's right that you have a good claim to be the owner of it. Mm-hmm. But he was wrong to say that the reason was that you owned your labor. You don't need to say that. You could still say you have a better claim to it because you have a connection to it because of what you did to it. But when he said you own your labor, he was trying to fight the monarchists, right? And the absolute monarchists of Filmer. And he was trying to say that God gave us ownership of the earth and ourselves, and if you own yourself, you own your labor. If you own your labor, you own the things you mix it with, blah, blah, blah. Like, his result is fine, but the problem was this idea that labor is this sort of substance that exudes from ourselves, that we own ourselves, so we own the labor. And I actually think that led to the Marxian, so Adam Smith, and then I guess Ricardo, and then Marx adopted this idea of labor as this thing, right? And so then Marx came up with this idea that, oh, well, if there's a worker on an assembly line and he uses his labor, which he owns, to create a car, and the employer makes a profit, he must be stealing something, you know, the surplus labor value from the employee. So I actually think that the unnecessary step of the Lockean labor theory of property led to Marxian labor theory of value and Marxism and communism, and also to intellectual property. Like, so the idea is like, oh, if you create a poem, mm-hmm. you created it, so you own it. So there's this whole fallacy that if you create something, you own it. And that's because people conflate the source of wealth with the source of property rights.
Okay. Yeah. No, I was tracking with you. It is funny, just as a quick aside, that I remember when I was at Hillsdale as a professor,
and I was teaching the students how that Marx didn't invent the labor theory of value. Like, that was the classical economist, of which, you know, if you had to classify Marx as a classical economist, and that Adam Smith and David Ricardo all believed in the labor theory of value to varying degrees, or the cost theory of value. And this, I remember some of the students were just pulling back. They were looking at me like I was, they, at first they thought I was nuts because I was a new professor. And then they went later and came to me and said, yeah, we just thought you were wrong about, holy cow, we never heard that. You know, Adam Smith is the, you know, inventor, father of capitalism and, you know, in economics. And you know, how could he have been here to, we've been taught labor theory of value equals Marx is equals bad. So anyway, it's okay. So you're, yeah, your problem, and I'm glad you got that out, is that, because I have seen that elsewhere, that you're saying that the your big problem with the idea that, oh, well, I created this poem and therefore it's mine, that where you attack that is just like at that first step, whereas a lot of people, even critics, even people that are critics of IP for whatever reasons, they probably would, you know, wouldn't object at that point, but you're trying to just, you know, even go right there and say, no, where's this coming from?
Right. I'm saying that the mistake is the idea that creation mm-hmm. is a source of property rights, and it's not. And if you think about it, again, as I said, the primary sources of property rights is homesteading, which is just taking something unowned from the wilderness. Mm-hmm. Or contract from some previous owner. Neither one of those involves creation. Creation to me is transformation or what we call production in economics. Like it's taking an original resource and transforming it into a more useful configuration. But again, legally, you have to ask who owns the input factors. That this is why that the factory workers on the Henry Ford factory line don't own the cars that they make.
You're right.
Because they didn't mm-hmm. they didn't own the input factors.
Go ahead. I was gonna say, like, if somebody breaks into my house and rearranges the furniture in a new way, they certainly can't say, I own that arrangement now. Like, that would be insane.
No. And the law has examples like that. Like, let's say you mm-hmm. have a big marble stone on your front lawn, and some brilliant artist next to you at midnight comes onto your lawn and just chisels a new brilliant sculpture from it. Mm-hmm. Who owns the sculpture? I mean, he created it, but he did it using your materials.
Right.
Now, right. I think libertarians would easily say he doesn't own it at all. Mm-hmm. Under the law, unfortunately, there's all these claims of unjust enrichment. So, like, you know, if you had a hunk of marble worth $1,000, and your insane neighbor named Dolly came over and carved a crazy statue into it, and now it's worth $1 million, the law might say it's unjust enrichment for you to be rewarded. For the trespass mm-hmm. claim or for the damage claim, more than $1,000, because your hunk of marble was only worth $1,000, and Dolly created most of the value. But you see, this is what you get when you get this Lockean / mm-hmm. Marxian mm-hmm. labor right. theory, where you focus on labor as a thing that people own. I mean, as a strict libertarian, I would say that, okay, if someone defaces my marble, I still own the marble, even though it's worth more now, right? That's mm-hmm. it's a simple case.
Right.
Do your intuitions match mine in this case?
Oh, yeah, definitely. And I was trying to come up with a more contrived example. Because there, like, if some guy, I think most people, if some guy comes onto my lawn, but I was trying to give a more contrived example where if somebody, like, quote, through no fault of his own or without malice, uses my property to do something, and right. then in so doing, for some reason, it ends up being to my benefit, is there, you know, could I, would it see, I'm trying to come up with a more reasonable to the layperson
case. I mean, the real cases in the law are cases like, let's say, for example, you and your neighbor have similar houses in our neighborhood, and your neighbor hires someone to, I don't know, mow your lawn or to paint your, to paint your house, let's say.
Yeah.
And the painter shows up and he paints your house on
accident. Just is mistaken. Yeah, okay, right.
It's an accident, but now you have a painted house and it's better and you're worth, it's worth more, and you're not actually upset about it. Now, in the, in that case, then the law is like back and forth. However, the interesting case would be if you show up halfway through lunch and you see the guy painting your house on accident and you just like, you wave him off or drive away because you're like, oh, I'm getting a free paint job. Mm-hmm. In that case, the law says, okay, look, you could have told the guy you're painting the wrong house, you know? And that's what's interesting about the law. There's all these kind of weird cases. But the point is, I think when you apply a libertarian lens to these things, sometimes, not always, but sometimes, you come out with a different conclusion about what the law should have done. Like, just because it's an evolved and a customary and a common law principle doesn't mean that it's necessarily just according to libertarian principles.
Right, right. Okay. Unfortunately, I have more questions I would want to keep asking you precisely along those lines about, is there a tension between like a priori armchair theorizing and the, no, this is what the law should be. And even though it might seem crazy in a certain circumstance, tough, versus like, oh, well, it's kind of ad hoc. And we just, oh, if we don't like something, then we just change the principles. That also doesn't seem right. And I guess that's what judges and are for in a common law type system, to, you know, use treatises and whatever to guide them, but they're the ones making the rulings. So with all that, I think I need to wrap it up at this point. So the book, folks, is, what is the title of it now? Legal Foundations of a Free Society. And is it currently available, or is it still in production? Are you still creating it and thus not owning it because of that?
It's out, and it's free on PDF on my website. And also, I'm going to put an EPUB up pretty soon, as soon as I get a few typos fixed.
Okay, great. All right, so of course, folks, I'll link to that at the show notes page of this if you want to see it, where to get it. So my guest has been Stefan Kinsella. Stefan, thanks so much for your time.
Thanks, Bob.
You've just experienced another episode of The Bob Murphy Show, the podcast promoting free markets, free minds, and grateful souls. For more information and to subscribe to this podcast, visit bobmurphyshow.com.